Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Velocity of Content. It's Friday, January 14th, 2022. Today, as we do every week, we check in with Publishers Weekly on news from the world of books and publishing. Andrew Albanese, PW Senior Writer, joins me with his reporting and editorial analysis. Welcome back to the program, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
Last time on the show, Andrew, you were reluctant to offer any predictions for what 2022 holds for the publishing industry. Nevertheless, I want to circle back on prognostications and ask whether 2022 is the year we widely return to in-person book conferences.
Well, you know, this week we had a few news items, right, from London and Bologna that suggest, you know, maybe it is. But I think it's fair to say that as 2022 opens, we remain a long way from establishing some kind of a new normal, right? The Omicron variant still continues to rip through so many places, leaving record numbers of infections and rising hospitalizations in place. And, you know, I know here in New York City, there's this feeling of like, we're all going to have COVID-19. It's inevitable, especially for people like me that have kids in school. On the other hand, we keep hearing from health officials that we may be nearing the crest of the Omicron wave and that it could start to fall very sharply and go away relatively quickly. So if you're a publisher and you're considering questions of getting back on the road and going to these shows, what do you do? You know, and I think that's a very, very complicated question. You know, already we've heard how publishers have pushed back their office requirements for many workers. And I think you can reasonably assume that no publisher is going to be putting people on a plane to head to conferences and book fairs when they're not even confident enough to have them take the subway to work. On the other hand, it is possible that by March, the infection rates will be back down to around or below 2%, which, of course, would change everything. And now into this mess, we have the organizers of the Bologna Children's Book Fair, who this week affirmed that they indeed intend to hold its in-person event in person. It's set for March 21 to 24. Elena Pasoli, who's the exhibition manager for Bologna, said that Omicron is expected to peak in Italy well before the fair. So she remains hopeful that the event will not be disrupted. Bologna, of course, is the world's most prominent fair for the children's and YA industry, and it is a hugely popular and important event. And it's also a very useful event. So Bologna is moving ahead with plans for a full fair, exhibitions, seminars, workshops, lectures. And this is also going to be the first year of its Bologna Book Plus, which is a new program aimed at the general and adult trade publishing market. The United Arab Emirate of Sharjah is set to be the guest of honor. And one important accommodation that Bologna is making, its prestigious Bologna Ragazzi Award program deadline has been extended. And in previous years, the award was only open to publishers who were actually exhibiting at Bologna. Well, they're now going to be open to any and all children's publishers who would like to submit books because, as Pasoli says, not everyone will want to or be able to travel to Bologna given the state of the pandemic, to which I say, Bologna in spring, I think everyone, yeah, wants to go. I know I do. But will they be able to? That indeed is a fair question.
London Book Fair organizers also underscored their plans for an in-person fair.
Yeah, the London Book Fair is now set for April 5 to 7. That is also open for registration. And this week, London Book Fair officials sent around a note affirming its intention to run an in-person show. And as my colleague Ed Nwaka reported this week, the fair sent an email out to potential attendees announcing that, yes, we're back. And it outlined this variety of safety protocols for potential attendees, which includes, I'm happy to say, proof of vaccination or at least of a negative test before you're able to enter Olympia. Getting into the UK may be a different story by then, but before you get into Olympia, you have to have proof of a vaccination or previous infection. And London Book Fair officials sound quite confident about their ability to pull this off. The email said that they're expecting 20,000 professional attendees, which, you know, it's down slightly because a typical London Book Fair would have about 25,000 attendees in all. But London Book Fair says it is looking forward to reuniting the publishing community for the first time in 2 years. Not exactly true because Frankfurt had an in-person fair. But, you know, the fair was, you know, canceled outright in the last minute in 2020, and it's been virtual events since. So I think a lot of people are probably kind of excited for the opportunity to get back to London in April. But I think London raises one of the more complicating factors facing travelers, and that is going to be what safety rules are going to be in place to travel when it comes to the springtime. You know, in London, for example, you know, attendees are also going to have to check in each and every day via the venue with a test and trace QR code. And, you know, I applaud all these safety measures, but until we see what happens, like especially what happens when a few positive cases actually turn up at Olympia and the orders to quarantine kick in, how that's all going to play out and whether or not the specter of that happening is enough to keep publishers on the sidelines for now. So, you know, I think the international fairs have a whole other set of challenges. As you know, the ABA canceled its Winter Institute. The ALA is having its winter event January to be virtual this year. But by springtime, I do wonder if that's all going to change. And while I very much hope to be in attendance in London in April, and I hope London and Bologna both have solid attendance, I can tell you that as an organization for us at PW, right now we don't know what we're doing, and it's not an easy call.
Certainly, the hope of reuniting publishing does hold appeal for many in the industry. But I wonder, after 2 years away, if there's any chance publishers are rethinking plans for these kind of events moving forward.
Yeah, I think that's a fair question. I think that's a question on a lot of people's minds, especially the book fair people. I think the longer you go not having these in-person events, the easier maybe it gets to start thinking like that. But I'll say this. I think publishers have always questioned their participation in these book fairs to some degree, right? There's somebody at the top who's always, and I'm just being honest here, who's looking at, you know, the cost and the payoff for these events. And I actually think that the last 2 years off have helped convince many in the publishing industry that, yeah, these fairs actually are important to them. More important, in fact, rather than less important. Still, I think it's all going to really be a question of scale and cost and what technology enables and what you really need to accomplish at these fairs. But the fact remains that you really do want to see your overseas business partners every year, at least once or twice a year, face to face, right? You really do. You know, virtual is great for expanding the reach of these fairs programming. We've seen a lot of great educational programming on Zoom this year, but it just doesn't replace the face-to-face interaction that I still think is very necessary to the business of publishing. Now, I think in 2022, the decisions are going to get a lot more complicated. I think just because we've discovered that, yeah, we like to get together in person, doesn't mean that that's going to solve the question. And I would imagine actually that the general counsel for many of these publishers is probably in the room when it comes to assessing the risk reward of sending employees out on the road during an uncertain pandemic. And the accountants, and I have to say that inflation and the rising costs of travel and the idea that you could very well find yourself stranded for a few extra days because of airline delays, that is surely, almost certainly has to be a factor, almost as much of a factor as the infection rates are right now for deciding what publishers are going to do in the early part of 2022. Now, I think the hope is that 2022 is going to be the year that we start to return to normal, that we do start returning to some of these larger book fairs and conferences. But the circumstances right now in January at the moment, I think they make it really hard to plan for anything that, you know, remotely approaches a return to normal.
As we covered throughout last year and as recently as last week, Andrew, trade book sales were up again sharply in 2021. This week, PW has a look at the top-selling titles of the year. What stood out to you?
Yeah, so congratulations to Dogman and Captain Underpants author Dave Pilkey, who, of course, was PW's 2019 Person of the Year, I might add. He continued his years-long remarkable sales performance in 2021. Pilkey boasted three of the year's top 25 best-selling books overall and five of the top 25 on the children's print list, and he was number one overall with a 10th entry in his Dogman series, Mothering Heights, with sales in 2021 nearing 1.3 million copies. He was followed by Jeff Kinney, author of Diary of a Wimpy Kid, who also placed three books on the list, including Big Shot, which is the 16th installment in his Wimpy Kid series. That landed at number three overall on the list for the year for 2021, despite only being published in August. So I have to say both authors loom large in my household here. I have a nine-year-old son who is now completing something like a PhD thesis on these two authors. You know, congratulations to both of them for more huge sales. But I think what stands out to me is that this year, a year that saw another huge year of sales growth for the industry, which we've talked about on this program, that only two books sold more than 1 million copies. And that's compared to seven books in 2019, which, of course, that year included Barack Obama's Promised Land, which sold more than 2.5 million copies. So in 2021, we had Pilkey with Mothering Heights, followed by Fox News host Mark R. Levin's Screed, American Marxism. Those were the only two titles to sell over a million copies. Also notable, Levin's was the only work of political nonfiction to crack the overall top 25. And our listeners will know, because we've talked about it on this program a lot, that is a massive change from the Trump years when we saw nonfiction sales paced by political bestsellers. But I think that's actually a good sign for the industry, because it shows even without these blockbusters and even without Trump in the White House pushing these books out there, forcing these books to be written, I should say, I think it's a good sign because it shows that readers are reading. Fiction sales are up and they're buying. You know, more broadly speaking, I think this augurs overall for the general health of the industry.
Romance publisher Harlequin, which is a division of HarperCollins, has announced the launch of Harlequin Plus, a multimedia subscription service. You think this news is a watershed moment and one you've waited for a long time?
Yeah, I think this is a pretty big deal. So we've been talking about this kind of subscription model access off and on for years. And now we finally have it from a publisher here in the U.S. You know, so there are subscription offerings in Europe, of course, especially in the audiobook market. But I think this is a big deal. I do, because and I take a look at the broader content landscape to say that, because virtually everything else I consume in the content market, movies, TV, music, it's all accessed by a subscription model these days, everything except books. Now, I want to back up a second, because there is a reason for that, right? There's a reason why everything we access, like movies and music, et cetera, subscription and books are not. And it's not just because, you know, publishers have been playing it too close to the vest and staying out of subscription game. I think it's because, and I firmly believe this, that print has proven itself to be the best technology for reading. And virtually everyone I know agrees, even my young children agree. I think that one thing that we've really learned over the last decade is that print has always been more resilient than we thought it was going to be back in the, you know, the early print is dead days of the digital revolution. And I think that realization about the strength and the power of print as a medium gives the industry a basis to now go ahead and try some new things, some new models, especially among certain genres where readers are perhaps more comfortable with digital reading. And my friend, that is the romance market to a T, right? So let me tell you a little bit about the offering. It's priced at $14.99 a month. It's called Harlequin Plus, and it's going to offer subscribers monthly book bundles and access to an ebook library and regularly updated selections of things like movies and games, too. It's going to be multimedia. And all this is going to be geared toward the romance reader. Now, the service is going to be available both, you know, through the Harlequin Plus website and the app. And the fact that they're going to have an app and do this now, I think, is also huge. Because when you have an app, you have a customer and you have customer data. You can push out to that customer. You can read about that customer's habits. You know, you don't want to get too creepy about it, but you'll learn a lot more about the person who's buying your product. And you have a relationship with that customer, right? You don't have that when you sell a print book, who they just take it and put it on a shelf when they're done with it. No, you have an ongoing relationship with an app. So I think that's a big part of this as well. Harlequin Executive VP and publisher Brent Lewis called Harlequin Plus one of the first multimedia subscription-based services to come out of book publishing. He's right, and that's a big deal. You know, the launch of Harlequin Plus is Harlequin's attempt to finally push into this broader, and I'll quote here, he says, broader content category. And it's an example of a publisher deciding to compete against competitive entertainment options. And that's, you know, also the way Brent put it, but he's absolutely right. I mean, everything else on the market that's out there available is this all-you-can-eat buffet subscription model, and now you have something from publishers as well. It makes perfect sense, too, that it's Harlequin, because we've discussed it many times over the years on the show, too. Romance readers are voracious, and from the start, they've all been very comfortable with the idea of digital reading because, to be honest, digital is the only way we can keep up with our considerable reading pace. You know, romance readers can read tons of books. You know, our listeners will recall that, you know, back in the early days of its service, the subscription service Scribd actually had to, quite controversially, I might add, scale back its romance offerings just because they couldn't keep up with the reader demand. Now, I'm also not surprised it's HarperCollins too, because Harper has always been one of the most eager of the big five publishers to experiment in the digital space. And look, one final point, I'm just going to amplify, you know, Brent Lewis's point here. Publishing needs to be in the space, even if it's just in a targeted way. You know, for too long, innovation in the industry has come from outside, right? What this program, I think, is saying more broadly is that Harper is recognizing the opportunity. It recognizes that reading is not immune to the broader trends in the content market, and it's just not going to outsource all of the innovation in the industry to other people and give its loyal customers away to third parties like Amazon, you know, when it has the ability to serve them. So I think this is a really smart move. It's a great move. I'm interested to see how it grows and if other publishers are going to follow their lead in other genres. And look, I'll be the first one to say that subscription is not going to work for all publishers. It's not going to work for all books, but it certainly should be part of the arsenal here in 2022.
Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer, thanks for joining me on the program today.
My pleasure, as always.
Coming up on the next podcast from CCC, audiobooks are an increasingly important part of the revenue pie for publishers. In 2020, audiobook sales topped $1.3 billion, a 12% jump over 2019. With few exceptions, human narrators, authors themselves, as well as actors and other artists, are heard in such recordings. AI-enabled automated ebook creation, however, lies just beyond the horizon, says electronic publishing analyst Thad McElroy. The shift from analog to digital voices, he reports, would lower production costs and lead to greater choice in titles, as well as mean a lot less work for Hollywood actors between pictures.
For certain books, it is simply not economical to bring in talent at that kind of price level and to go into the studio and you know, have the kind of production values that are in a podcast like this. So, you know, the choice becomes an either or, it's a binary choice. Are we going to get an audiobook for this backlist title or not? Because if we have to go through traditional production methods, it's simply not going to be financially possible.
This audiobook was narrated by no one. Coming on the next CCC podcast. Our producer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. You can subscribe to the program wherever you go for podcasts, and please do follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for listening. Join us again soon for another Velocity of Content podcast from CCC.